question we always ask is, how could this happen? That was the world's reaction in August 2013 when disturbing images surfaced of civilians, including many children, lying lifeless after poisoned gas attacks in the suburbs of Damascus, Syria. But military use of dreadful arms always occurs after people devoted a lot of brain power and effort to developing the weapons in the first place. Historian Robert Neer took me on a tour of Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
This is the location of a top-secret basement research laboratory that was created by the university in 1942 to house Professor Louis Fieser, who was a genius and a very prominent member, although quite young still, of the Harvard chemistry faculty, and a select group of assistants that had been assembled by him to conduct government-financed war research on first poison gas, but then later incendiary weapons. The initial task was to develop a kind of thickening agent for gasoline based on rubbers. But after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor cut off much of the rubber supply to the United States, the research turned to finding chemical alternatives for rubber that could be used to produce gelled weapons that are very sticky and consequently more effective at starting fires.
The Imperial Japanese Navy's assault on Hawaii ignited World War II. This heightened the urgency of American weapons researchers, who were also eyeing the ominous march of Nazi Germany through Europe.
On Valentine's Day, 1942, Fieser and his team notified the government that they had developed a formulation that they called napalm.
A quarter century later, the use of napalm, a sticky gel that causes severe burns to human skin, would come to symbolize the brutality of the Vietnam War, especially in its horrific impact on civilian peasants. The weapons development, which tapped the minds of gifted scientists, is chronicled in Robert Neer's book, Napalm, An American Biography.
Chemists have been at work and war engineers since the 1940s, and newer napalms burn even hotter and are even more sticky than earlier napalms.
How hot are we talking about?
About 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, approximately.
2,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah. So that's hotter than anything that most people are likely to come in contact with in their normal course of existence. But it's not the heat that's the real problem, as it were, or the really devastating thing. The real problem is that it's sticky, so that it will burn and then continue to burn and be very hard to stop burning as it continues down into someone's skin. Experiments that have been done by military researchers indicate, not surprisingly, that even a very small amount of napalm placed on someone's shirt would very soon, within a few seconds, create excruciating pain as it burned through the cloth and into the skin. And if the blob of napalm is large enough, it can continue to burn all the way down to the bone.
The first field test of a napalm bomb occurred on July 4, 1942, at the Harvard College soccer field. A photo of the test site shows people playing tennis on nearby courts. Other experiments involved gel packed around gunpowder, which was detonated in a remote area of Everett, Massachusetts, a working-class town about 5 miles outside Cambridge. Eventually, the scientists had refined napalm to the point where it could be mass-produced.
During World War II, a variety of companies, about a half a dozen, produced napalm because the government was trying to make as much as possible. As soon as the military forces saw it in operation in World War II, they wanted to get more. In fact, in Japan, when it was first used against the city of Tokyo on the 9th of March, 1945, it was judged to be so effective that particular attack killed more people than any other in the history of the world, more even than the atomic explosions at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So the commanders felt that that was such a victory that they would continue to use as much napalm as they could, as quickly as they could.
Over 100,000 humans were killed as wave after wave of bombers came in and dropped both incendiary bombs, napalm, and explosives.
Everett Mendelsohn is emeritus professor of the history of science at Harvard. He came to the university a decade after napalm was invented there. Dr. Mendelsohn has long studied and taught about the social implications of scientific research.
We knew of how this material, napalm, had been used. It had been used in the firebombing of cities, Dresden, Hamburg, the two in which the nature of war had been proven to be changed. Instead of bombing specific military or strategic targets, you now bombed whole cities. And you drop napalm on those cities as a way to wipe out the manner in which daily life was lived. As I recall, Winston Churchill called it, we wanted to de-house the residents of those towns. So napalm was not new to us.
Anti-war demonstrators protest U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War in mass marches, rallies, and demonstrations. Central Park is the starting point for the parade to the U.N. building. The estimated 125,000 Manhattan marchers include students, housewives, beatnik poets, doctors, businessmen, teachers, priests, and nuns.
In 1967, a year when the anti-Vietnam War movement gained momentum in America, Everett Mendelsohn was one of over 100 Boston-area professors to sign a newspaper ad supporting students who protested campus recruitment by Dow Chemical Corporation, the chief supplier of napalm.
The image that was strongest in the minds of those of us who had looked at it and knew something of its history was that it was noncombatants who turned out to be the major targets. If you used napalm on a military installation, people would not have worried about it much. But when you use it as an instrument for burning out whole cities in which non-combatants lived, you became more and more worried. So that when they began using napalm in Vietnam, our antennae went up. We were aware of the fact that this meant that they were broadening the targets and they were going to, be careless in whether they were going after military installations or human residences.
This way of settling differences is not just.
Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. at the Riverside Church, New York City, April 1967.
This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love.
One of the most vivid and haunting depictions of napalm was that famous photograph of a young girl named Kim Phuc taken in South Vietnam in June of 1972. Can you just tell us about that?
A South Vietnamese airplane appeared badly off course and dropped several napalm bombs, one of which caught Kim in a fire cloud and burned her over more than half of her body and her back and her head, so that when the picture was taken, she was running burned naked because of the fire that had enveloped her and with portions of her skin still burning.
She was 9 years old.
She was 9 years old.
She's now about 50 years old, living in Canada. Have you been in contact with her?
I have been. She very kindly spoke to me a number of times about her experiences and said that she was filled with rage after what happened to her because it was so unjust. What possible basis could there be for practically burning alive a 9-year-old? And over decades, she came to the personal realization that that rage was actually destructive to her. And so she found God, converted to Christianity, found enormous comfort through that belief, and forgave the people who had done this to her in every context.